They've got 8 stomachs, Vimes remembered. The drawings in the book had been very detailed. And there's lots of other stuff, like fractional distillation tubes and mad alchemy sets in there. No swamp dragon could ever terrorize a kingdom, except by accident. Vimes wondered how many had been killed by enterprising heroes. It was terribly cruel to do something like that to creatures whose only crime was to blow themselves absent-mindedly to pieces in mid-air, which was not something any individual dragon made a habit of. It made him quite angry to think about it. A race of whittles. That's what dragons were. Born to lose. Live fast, die wide. Omnivores or not, what they must really live on was their nerves, flapping apologetically through the world in mortal fear of their own digestive system. The family would just be getting over father's explosion, and some twerp in a suit of armour would come plodding into the swamp to stick a sword into a bag of guts that was only one step away from self-destruction in any case. It'd be interesting to see how the great dragon slayers of the past stood up to the big dragon. Armour? Best not to wear it. It'd be all the same in any case, and at least your ashes wouldn't come prepackaged in their own foil. He stared and stared at the malformed little thing, and the idea that had been knocking for attention for the last few minutes finally gained entrance. Everyone in Ankh-Morpork wanted to find the dragon's lair, at least wanted to find it empty. Bits of wood on a stick wouldn't do it, he was certain. But as they said, set a thief. The phrase, set a thief to catch a thief, had by this time, after strong representation from the Thieves' Guild, replaced a much older and quintessentially Ankh-Morporkian proverb, which was, set a deep hole with spring-loaded sides, tripwires and whirling knife blades driven by water power, broken glass and scorpions, to catch a thief. He said, could one dragon sniff out another? I mean, follow a scent? Dearest Mother, wrote Carrot, talk about a turn-up for the books. Last night the dragon burned up our headquarters, and lo and behold, we have been given a better one. It is in a place called Pseudopolis Yard, opposite the Opera House. Sergeant Colon said we have gone up in the world, and has told Nobby not to try to sell the furnishings. Going up in the world is a metaphor, which I am learning about. It is like lying, but more decorative. There are proper carpets to spit on. Twice today, groups of people have tried to search the cellars here for the dragon. It is amazing. And digging up people's privies, and poking into attics, it is like a fever. One thing is, people haven't got time for much else, and Sergeant Colon says, when you go out on your rounds and shout 12 o'clock and all's well while a dragon is melting the street, you feel a bit of a Burke. I have moved out of Mrs. Palm's because there are dozens of bedrooms here. It was sad, and they made me a cake, but I think it is for the best, although Mrs. Palm never charged me rent, which was very nice of her considering she is a widow with so many fine daughters to bring up, plus dowries, etc. Also, I have made friends with this ape, who keeps coming round to see if we have found his book. Nobby says it is a flea-ridden moron because it won 18 pence off him playing Cripple Mr. Onion, which is a game of chance with cards which I do not play. I have told Nobby about the gambling, brackets, regulation acts, and he said, piss off, which I think is in violation of the decency ordinances of 1389, but I have decided to use my discretion. Captain Vimes is ill and being looked after by a lady. Nobby says it is well known she is mental, but Sergeant Colon says it is just because of living in a big house with a lot of dragons, but she is worth a fortune, and well done to the captain for getting his feet under the table. I do not see what the furniture has to do with it. This morning I went for a walk with Reet and showed her many interesting examples of the ironwork to be found in the city. She said it was very interesting. She said I was quite different to anyone she's ever met. Your loving son, Carrot, X. P.S. I hope Minty is keeping well. He folded the paper carefully and shoved it into the envelope. Sun's going down. I'll have to do that again. Sun's going down, said Sergeant Colon. Carrot looked up from his sealing wax. That means it'll be night soon, Colon went on, accurately. Yes, Sergeant. Colon ran a finger round his collar. His skin was impressively pink, the result of a morning's scrubbing, but people were still staying at a respectful distance. Some people are born to command, some people achieve command, and others have command thrust upon them. And the sergeant was now included in this category and wasn't very happy about it. Any minute now, he knew he was going to have to say that it was time they went out on patrol. He didn't want to go out on patrol. He wanted to find a nice sub-basement somewhere. But noblesse oblige. If he was in charge, he had to do it. It wasn't the loneliness of command that was bothering him. It was the being fried alive of command that was giving him problems. He was also pretty sure that unless they came up with something about this dragon very soon, then the patrician was going to be unhappy. And when the patrician was unhappy, he became very democratic. He found intricate and painful ways of spreading that unhappiness as far as possible. Responsibility, the sergeant thought, was a terrible thing. So was being horribly tortured. As far as he could see, the two facts were rapidly heading towards one another. And thus he was terribly relieved when a small coach pulled up outside the yard. It was very old and battered. There was a faded coat of arms on the door. Painted on the back, and rather newer, was the little message, "Winnie, if you love dragons." Out of it, wincing as he got down, stepped Captain Vimes. Following him was the woman known to the sergeant as Mad Sybil Ramkin, and finally, hopping down obediently on the end of its lead, was a small... The sergeant was too nervous to take account of actual size. "Well, I'll be mogadored. They've only gone and caught it." Nobby looked up from the table in the corner, where he was continually failing to learn that it is impossible to play a game of skill and bluff against an opponent who smiles all the time. The librarian took advantage of the diversion to help himself to a couple of cards off the bottom of the pack.
"Don't be daft. That's just a swamp dragon," said Nobby. "She's all right as Lady Sybil. A real lady."
The other two guards turned and stared at him. This was Nobby talking.
"You two can bloody well stop that," he said. "Why shouldn't I know a lady when I sees one? She'd give me a cup of tea and a cup thin as paper and a silver spoon in it," he said, speaking as one who had peeped over the plateau of social distinction. "And I'll give it back to her, so you can stop looking at me like that." "What is it you actually do on your evenings off?" said Colon. "No business of yourn."
"Did you really give the spoon back?" said Carrot.
"Yes, I bloody well did," said Nobby hotly.
"Attention, lad," said the sergeant, flooded with relief. The other two entered the room. Vimes gave his men his usual look of resigned dismay. "My squad," he mumbled. "Fine body of men," said Lady Ramkin. "The good old rank and file, eh?" "The rank, anyway," said Vimes. Lady Ramkin beamed encouragingly. This led to a strange shuffling among the men. Sergeant Colon, by dint of some effort, managed to make his chest stick out more than his stomach. Carrot straightened up from his habitual stoop. Nobby vibrated with soldierly bearing, hands thrust straight down by his sides, thumbs pointing sharply forward. Pigeon chest inflated so much that his feet were in danger of leaving the ground.
"I always think we can all sleep safer in my bed, knowing that these brave men are watching over us," said Lady Ramkin, walking sedately along the rank like a treasure galleon running ahead of a mild breeze. "And who is this?"
It's difficult for an orangutan to stand to attention. Its body can master the general idea, but its skin can't. The librarian was doing his best, however, standing in a sort of respectful heap at the end of the line and maintaining the kind of complex salute you can only achieve with a 4-foot arm.
"He's plain clothes, ma'am," said Nobby smartly. "Special ape services."
Very enterprising indeed," said Lady Ramkin. "How long have you been an ape, my man?"
"Ooh, well done,"
she turned to Vimes, who was definitely looking incredulous.
"A credit to you," she said. "A fine body of men."
"Ooh."
"Anthropoids," corrected Lady Ramkin, with barely a break in the flow. For a moment, the rank felt as though they had just returned from single-handedly conquering a distant province. They felt, in fact, tremendously bucked up, which was how Lady Ramkin would almost certainly have put it, and which was definitely several letters of the alphabet away from how they normally felt. Even the librarian felt favoured, and for once had let the phrase, "my man," pass without comment. A trickling noise and a strong chemical smell prompted them to look around. Good boy Bindle Featherstone was squatting with an air of sheepish innocence alongside what was not so much a stain on the carpet as a hole in the floor. A few wisps of smoke were curling up from the edges. Lady Ramkin sighed.
"Don't you worry, ma'am," volunteered Nobby cheerfully. "Soon have that cleaned up."
"I'm afraid they're often like that when they're excited," she said.
"Fine specimen you got there, ma'am,"
Nobby went on, revelling in the new-found experience of social intercourse.
"It's not mine," she said. "It belongs to the captain now, or all of you, perhaps, a sort of mascot. His name is Good Boy Bindle Featherstone."
Good Boy Bindle Featherstone bore up stoically under the weight of the name, and sniffed a table leg.
"He looks more like my brother Errol," said Nobby, playing the cheapy-chirpy, lovable city sparrow card for all it was worth. "Got the same pointed nose, excuse me for saying so, me lady."
Vimes looked at the creature, which was investigating its new environment, and knew that it was now irrevocably an Errol. The little dragon took an experimental bite out of the table, chewed it for a few seconds, spat it out, curled up, and went to sleep.
"He ain't going to set fire to anything, is he?" said the sergeant, anxiously.
"I don't think so. He doesn't seem to have worked out what his flame ducts are for yet,"
said Lady Ramkin.
"You can't teach him anything about relaxing, though," said Vimes. "Anyway, Ben—"
"Ooh!
I wasn't talking to you, sir. What's this doing here?"
Said Sergeant Colon hurriedly. "With you being away and all, and us likely to be short-handed, Carrot here says it's all according to the law and that. I swore him in, sir.
The ape, sir."
"Swore him in what, Sergeant?" said Vimes.
"As special constable, sir," said Colon, blushing. "You know, sir, sort of citizen's watch."
Vimes threw up his hands.
"Special? Bloody unique!"
The librarian gave Vimes a big smile.
"Just temporarily, sir, for the duration, like," said Colon pleadingly. "We could do with the help, sir, and, well, he's the only one who seems to like us."
"I think it's a frightfully good idea," said Lady Ramkin. "Well done, that ape!"
Vimes shrugged. The world was mad enough already. What could make it worse?
"Okay," he said. "Okay, I give in. Fine. Give him a badge, although I'm damned if I know where he'll wear it. Fine, yes. Why not?"
"You all right, Captain?" said Colon, all concerned.
"Fine, fine. Welcome to the new watch," snapped Vimes, striding vaguely round the room. "Great. After all, we pay peanuts, don't we? So we might as well employ a monkey."
The sergeant's hand slapped respectfully across Vimes's mouth.
"Just one thing, Captain," said Colon urgently to Vimes' astonished eyes. "You don't use the M word. Gets right up his nose, sir. He can't help it. He loses all self-control, like a red rag to a what's-her-name, sir. Ape is all right, sir, but not the M word. Because, sir, when he gets angry, he doesn't just go and sulk, sir, if you get my drift. He's no trouble apart from that, sir. All right? Just don't say monkey. Oh, shit!"
The brethren were nervous. He'd heard them talking. Things were moving too fast for them. He thought he'd led them into the conspiracy a bit at a time, never giving them more truth than their little brains could cope with. But he'd still overestimated them. A firm hand was needed. Firm, but fair.
"Brothers," said the Supreme Grand Master, "are the cuffs of veracity duly enhanced?"
"What?" said Brother Watchtower, vaguely. "Oh, the cuffs! Yeah! Enhanced, right!"
"And the martlets of beckoning, are they fittingly divested?"
Brother Plasterer gave a guilty start.
"Me? What? Oh, fine. No problem. Divested, yes."
The Supreme Grand Master paused.
"Brothers," he said softly, "we are so near. Just once more, just a few hours. Once more, and the world is ours. Do you understand, brothers?"
Brother Plasterer shuffled a foot.
"Well," he said, "I mean, of course, yes. No fears about that. Behind you, 110%.
"He's going to say only," thought the Supreme Grand Master.
"Only,
we, that is, all of us, we've been... odd, really. You feel so different, don't you, after summoning the dragon? Sort of,
cleaned out," said Brother Plasterer, helpfully.
Yes, like it's sort of...
Brother Watchtower struggled with the serpents of self-expression.
Taking something out of you.
Sucked dry, said Brother Plasterer.
Yes, like he said, and we... well, it's maybe... it's a bit risky.
Like stuff's been dragged from your actual living brain by eldritch creatures from beyond, said Brother Plasterer.
I'd have said more like a bit of a sick headache myself, said Brother Watchtower helplessly. And we was wondering, you know, about all this stuff about cosmic balance and that, because, well, look what happened to poor old Dunnikin. Could be a bit of a judgment,
It was just a maddened crocodile hidden in a flowerbed, said the Supreme Grand Master. It could have happened to anyone. I understand your feelings, however.
You do? Said Brother Watchtower.
Oh, yes. They're only natural. All the greatest wizards feel a little ill at ease before undertaking a great work such as this.
The brethren preened themselves. Great wizards. That's us.
Yeah.
But in a few hours, it'll be over, and I am sure that the king will reward you handsomely. The future will be glorious. This normally did the trick. It didn't appear to be working this time.
But the dragon,
Brother Watchtower began.
There won't be any dragon. We won't need it. Look, said the Supreme Grand Master. It's quite simple. The lad will have a marvellous sword. Everyone knows kings have marvellous swords.
This would be the marvellous sword you've been telling us about, would it? Said Brother Plasterer.
And when it touches the dragon, said the Supreme Grand Master, it'll be vroom.
Yeah, they do that, said Brother Doorkeeper. My uncle kicked a swamp dragon once. He found it eating his pumpkins. Damn thing nearly took his leg off.
The Supreme Grand Master sighed. A few more hours, yes, and then no more of this. The only thing he hadn't decided was whether to let them alone, who'd believe them after all, or send the guard to arrest them for being terminally stupid.
No, he said patiently, I mean the dragon will vanish. We'll have sent it back. End of dragon.
Won't people be a bit suspicious? Said Brother Plasterer. Won't they expect lumps of real dragon all over the place?
No, said the Supreme Grand Master triumphantly, because one touch from the sword of truth and justice will totally destroy the spawn of evil.
The brethren stared at him.
That's what they'll believe anyway, he added. We can provide a bit of mystic smoke at the time.
Dead easy, mystic smoke, said Brother Fingers.
No bits, then, said Brother Plasterer, a shade disappointed.
Brother Watchtower coughed.
Don't know if people will accept that, he said. Sounds a bit too neat, like.
Listen, snapped the Supreme Grand Master. They'll accept anything. They'll see it happen. People will be so keen to see the boy win, they won't think twice about it. Depend upon it. Now, let us commence.
He concentrated. Yes, it was easier. Easier every time. He could feel the scales, feel the rage of the dragon as he reached into the place where the dragons went and took control. This was power, and it was his. Sergeant Colon winced.
Ow!
Don't be a big softy, said Lady Ramkin cheerfully, tightening the bandage with a well-practiced skill handed down through many generations of Ramkin womenfolk. He hardly touched you.
And he's very sorry, said Carrot sharply. Show the sergeant how sorry you are. Go on.
Ook, said the librarian sheepishly.
Don't let him kiss me, squeaked Colon.
Do you think picking someone up by their ankles and bouncing their head on the floor comes under the heading of striking a superior officer? Said Carrot.
I'm not pressing charges, me, said the sergeant hurriedly.
Can we get on? Said Vimes impatiently. We're going to see if Errol could sniff out the dragon's lair. Lady Ramkin thinks it's got to be worth a try.
You mean set a deep hole with spring-loaded sides, tripwires, whirling knife blades driven by water power, broken glass and scorpions to catch a thief, Captain? Said the sergeant doubtfully.
Ow!
Yes, we don't want to lose the scent, said Lady Ramkin.
Stop being a big baby, Sergeant.
"'Brilliant idea about using Errol, ma'am, if I may make so bold,'
said Nobby, while the sergeant blushed under his bandage.
Vimes was not certain how long he would be able to put up with Nobby the social mountaineer. Carrot said nothing. He was gradually coming to terms with the fact that he probably wasn't a dwarf, but dwarf blood flowed in his veins in accordance with the famous principle of morphic resonance, and his borrowed genes were telling him that nothing was going to be that simple. Finding a hoard, even when the dragon wasn't at home, was pretty risky. Anyway, he was certain he'd know if there was one around. The presence of large amounts of gold always made a dwarf's palms itch, and his weren't itching.
"We'll start by that wall in the shades," said the captain.
Sergeant Colon glanced sideways at Lady Ramkin and found it impossible to show cowardice in the face of the supportive. He contented himself with,
"Is that wise, Captain?"
"Of course it isn't. If we were wise, we wouldn't be in the watch."
"I say, all this is tremendously exciting," said Lady Ramkin.
"Oh, I don't think you should come, m'lady," Vimes began.
"Sybil, please.
It's a very disreputable area, you see. But I'm sure I shall be perfectly safe with your men," she said. "I'm sure vagabonds just melt away when they see you."
"That's dragons," thought Vimes. "They melt away when they see dragons and just leave their shadows on the wall." Whenever he felt that he was slowing down or that he was losing interest, he remembered those shadows, and it was like having dull fire poured down his backbone. Things like that shouldn't be allowed to happen. Not in my city. In fact, the shades were not a problem. Many of its denizens were out hoard-hunting anyway, and those that remained were far less inclined than hitherto to lurk in dark alleys. Besides, the more sensible of them recognised that Lady Ramkin, if waylaid, would probably tell them to pull up their socks and not be silly, in a voice so used to command that they would probably find themselves doing it. The wall hadn't been knocked down yet, and still bore its grisly fresco. Errol sniffed around it, trotted up the alley once or twice, and went to sleep.
"Didn't work," said Sergeant Colon.
"Good idea, though," said Nobby, loyally.
"It could be all the rain and people walking about, I suppose," said Lady Ramkin.
Vimes scooped up the dragon. It had been a vain hope, anyway. It was just better to be doing something than nothing.
"We'd better get back," he said. "The sun's gone down."
They walked back in silence. The dragon's even tamed the shades, Vimes thought. It's taken over the whole city, even when it isn't here. People'll start tying virgins to rocks any day now. It's a metaphor of human bloody existence, a dragon. And if that wasn't bad enough, it's also a bloody great hot flying thing. He pulled out the key to the new headquarters. While he was fumbling in the lock, Errol woke up and started to yammer.
"Not now," Vimes said.
His side twinged. The night had barely started, and already he felt too tired. A slate slid down the roof and smashed on the cobbles beside him.
"Captain," hissed Sergeant Colon.
"What?"
"It's on the roof, Captain."
Something about the sergeant's voice got through to Vimes. It wasn't excited, it wasn't frightened. It just had a tone of dull, leaden terror. He looked up. Errol started to bounce up and down under his arm. The dragon, was peering down interestedly over the guttering. Its face alone was taller than a man. Its eyes were the size of very large eyes, coloured a smouldering red and filled with an intelligence that had nothing to do with human beings. It was far older, for one thing. It was an intelligence that had already been long basted in guile and marinated in cunning by the time a group of almost monkeys were wondering whether standing on two legs was a good career move. It wasn't an intelligence that had any truck with or even understood the arts of diplomacy. It wouldn't play with you or ask you riddles. But it understood all about arrogance and power and cruelty, and if it could possibly manage it, it would burn your head off. Because it liked to. It was even more angry than usual at the moment. It could sense something behind its eyes. A tiny, weak, alien mind bloated with self-satisfaction. It was infuriating, like an unscratchable itch. It was making it do things it didn't want to do, and stopping it from doing things it wanted to do very much. Those eyes were, for the moment, focused on Errol, who was going frantic. Vimes realized that all that stood between him and a million degrees of heat was the dragon's vague interest in why Vimes had a smaller dragon under his arm.
"Don't make any sudden moves," said Lady Ramkin's voice behind him, "and don't show fear."
They can always tell when you're afraid.
"Is there any other advice you can offer at this time?" said Vimes, slowly, trying to speak without moving his lips.
"Well, tickling them behind the ears often works."
"Oh," said Vimes weakly.
"And a good sharp no, and taking away their food bowl."
"Uh-huh."
"And hitting them on the nose with a roll of paper is what I do in extreme cases."
In the slow, brightly outlined, desperate world Vimes was now inhabiting, which seemed to revolve around the craggy nostrils a few metres away from him, he became aware of a gentle hissing sound. The dragon was taking a deep breath. The intake of air stopped. Vimes looked into the darkness of the flame ducts and wondered whether he'd see anything, whether there'd be some tiny white glow or something, before fiery oblivion swept over him. At that moment, a horn rang out. The dragon raised its head in a puzzled way and made a noise that sounded vaguely interrogative without being in any way a word. The horn rang out again. The noise seemed to have a number of echoes that lived a life of their own. It sounded like a challenge. If that wasn't what it was, then the hornblower was soon going to be in trouble, because the dragon gave Vimes a smouldering look, unfolded its enormous wings, leapt heavily into the air, and against all the rules of aeronautics, flew slowly away in the direction of the sound. Nothing in the world should have been able to fly like that. The wings thumped up and down with a noise like potted thunder, but the dragon moved as though it was idly sculling through the air. If it stopped flapping, the movement suggested, it would simply glide to a halt. It floated, not flew. For something the size of a barn with an armor-plated hide, it was a pretty good trick. It passed over their heads like a barge, heading for the Plaza of Broken Moons.
"Follow it!" shouted Lady Ramkin. "That's not right, it flying like that. I'm pretty sure there's something in one of the witchcraft laws," said Carrot, taking out his notebook. "And it's damaged the roof. It's really piling up the offences, you know."
"You all right, Captain?" said Sergeant Colon.
"I could see right up its nose," said Captain Vimes dreamily. His eyes focused on the worried face of the sergeant. "Where's it gone?" he demanded. Colon pointed along the street. Vimes glowered at the shape disappearing over the rooftops.
"Follow it," he said.
The horn sounded again. Other people were hurrying towards the plaza. The dragon drifted ahead of them like a shark heading towards a wayward airbed, its tail flicking slowly from side to side.
"Some loony's going to fight it," said Nobby.
"I thought someone would have a go," said Colon. "Poor bugger'll be baked in his own armour." This seemed to be the opinion of the crowds lining the plaza. The people of Ankh-Morpork had a straightforward, no-nonsense approach to entertainment, and while they were looking forward to seeing a dragon slain, they'd be happy to settle instead for seeing someone being baked alive in his own armour. You didn't get the chance every day to see someone baked alive in their own armour. It would be something for the children to remember. Vimes was jostled and bounced around by the crowd as more people flooded into the plaza behind them. The horn sounded a third challenge.
"That's a slug horn, that is," said Colon knowledgeably. "Like a toxin, only deeper."
"You sure?" said Nobby.
"Yep.
Must have been a bloody big slug."